Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Gallin. Well, no one on the campaign trail has yet to take on education or our incarceration crisis in a deep and substantive way. Actress and playwright Anna Deavere Smith is taking on both. Her new one-woman show, actually it's one woman and one man from what I understand, is Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, which lays out how a civil rights crisis is flaring up at the intersection of our education system and mass incarceration problem. It'll be on stage at the Great ART in Cambridge August 20 through September 17th. She's an actress. You probably know her from Nurse Jackie and The West Wing and a whole bunch of things, and playwright among her numerous honors. She's received the 2012 National Humanities Medal from President Obama. Anna Deavere Smith, it is a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me over.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. And in terms of the education system and the mess, particularly in urban education, being a civil rights issue, you are speaking to the choir here.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Because, well, give us a thesis. Give us a thesis of your new play.
Oh, well, the thesis is that the Department of Justice some years ago came out with statistics that reveal that Black, Brown, Native American children from poor communities are punished more harshly than their brothers and sisters of other social classes. They're suspended from school and expelled from school at higher rates, and that these suspensions and expulsions are a very good prediction that they will end up in the criminal justice system as adults, but on the way that they're going to be in the juvenile justice system.
Are you aware that there was a city council in Boston just had a big hearing under City Councilor Tito Jackson maybe, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
On exactly the same issue that you're talking about, how zero tolerance, including for kindergarten kids, 4 and 5 year olds at some charter and traditional public schools, is leading to exactly the same kind of thing. So the issue is as front and center here as it's going to be in Cambridge at the ART. Can you describe how you approach these things you do, which is unlike how anybody else on the planet does it?
Let me talk about that briefly from two ways. One is that I interview people and then I make these one-person shows where I perform all the parts of the people I interviewed. Excuse me. When I was a girl growing up in Baltimore, my grandfather, who had an eighth grade education, said that if you say a word often enough, it becomes you. If you say a word often enough, it becomes you. And I think in a way, just trying to heal the crisis of having grown up in a de facto segregated city, I decided to try to become America word for word. So I've been going around for a long time now, since late 70s, working on an oeuvre called On the Road, A Search for American Character, where I just interview lots and lots of people, usually about subjects where there's more than one point of view. And for this project, I went to 4 geographic areas to do my interviews: Northern California, on the Yurok Reservation, and also in Stockton, which at the time was bankrupt, Philadelphia, Baltimore, my hometown, right after the riots last year, and then finally we went around South Carolina, up and down the Corridor of Shame, and also, of course, to Charleston and Columbia. So that's how I work. But the other way I work started here in Cambridge in the late 90s. I had an institute at Harvard called the Institute on the Arts and Civic Dialogue, with the whole idea of using and designing a work of art specifically to foster civic engagement.
Was that the thing you won the MacArthur for? Or was that not the thing?
No.
What'd you win the MacArthur
Genius
for?
Award.
I got the MacArthur for my work of trying to become America word for word.
Okay. So, but
she's a genius. We just want to be clear about that.
Harvard.
So-called. It's in quotation marks.
We talk a lot about civic dialogue and lack of same. What were you doing there?
Well, I felt that, you know, we could experiment with what it means to bring a work of art out and put it in civic space, and those works were works in progress, and put them in civic space to see if they could engender a different kind of civic dialogue. So in this play, I created it in such a way that I play what's a traditional first act, several characters, and then we're going to set the audience off in small groups to talk among themselves for 20 minutes about this matter, and then come back. And then I do a coda, and hopefully when they come back, they're looking at it from a different point of view. Look, my idea is all I can do is do my research, try to write a decent play, if I'm lucky, make you laugh and cry. But there are people in the audience who can do a lot more than me in their city.
Can I tell you something?
This is a place where stuff can happen, I believe.
I can't wait to see this thing, by the way. However, there's a big however. The whole notion of how you do the second act thing gives me hives.
Why?
Because
but you do a version of it here on the radio.
I feel pressured already. I'm thinking about what day I'm going to come. So we listen
well,
to you.
I hope you'll come more than once.
Well, I hope I will, too. So we listen to you, And then we...
You watch me and listen to me.
Okay, and then do we...
You cry with me and you laugh
okay,
with me.
Okay, fine. We'll do all listening. That. And then do we have breakout groups in which we have discussions
groups,
about
yeah.
solutions based upon what you've shared?
Well, not just solutions. It's not just solutions. Look, so, you know, the big thing, I don't know when anybody came up with this phrase. I think it's a terrible phrase of a takeaway. You know, it's first
takeaway.
I'm
yeah.
so glad y'all haven't asked me that. Maybe you were going to.
Maybe like, we're not anymore. Tell me. That was the last question.
What's the takeaway?
What's the takeaway?
What's the takeaway?
I've done it once or twice.
I've taught for 40 years. You know, it's everybody's bringing something. And particularly in an environment like where the ART is, you know, that everybody's coming with something. You're coming with an experience of your own education. You're coming with a lot of feelings about what's going on in the United States right now with regard, whatever side you're on, with regard to mass incarceration, with regard to what's going on in the cities with authority figures, particularly police officers and African-American and other men and women.
Can we stay on this just for one more second?
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to prepare myself. So we go into these groups.
Yeah.
Do we come back and report? What do we
no,
do?
No, there's no reporting.
Then I feel better already. We just talk amongst
no
ourselves.
It's no reporting.
Okay, fine.
But
I'm
on something
doing,
like
better.
this, you know, talking about kids of color getting shafted and the schools basically getting expelled and all that, more than white kids, Asian kids, et cetera. You know, there's the opportunity. We always talk we're going to have a conversation about race, right?
That's right. Where are you having it?
Yeah,
where are you having
exactly.
it?
At the ART on August 20th. That's where we're at.
Where are you having
it? It's always very fascinating, I think, because...
I wish you could see the look on Anna's face.
Really?
Well, it's always very fascinating because, you know, five African-Americans alone and five white people alone are going to have a much different conversation
five
about
Asians
race.
Five Asians have it alone.
Exactly.
Five Latinos have it.
Then if you have three African-Americans and three white people and three Asian people, whatever, it's always so tense.
And different social classes as well.
Different social classes.
And look,
a big
you know,
deal.
Things get more and more segregated as we go on. You know, as I say, I've been teaching for 40 years. My students have become wealthier and wealthier and more educated, you know, I teach graduate students at NYU, right? Because who gets to go to NYU? Who gets
can't
to go to Harvard?
Can't afford it.
60
yeah.
grand to go to school in the arts? Come on.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about some of the people you become?
Yes. Well, I do portraits. I'm not so, you know, I don't know who said I become people. Or I
just said that.
Well, other people, you
I'm
know,
not
that
ask
what's
you
the
about
other
the
word? What's the
somewhere.
Other word? There's another word. Oh, I'll think of it in a minute. That's used sometime. No, I'm making portraits, right? Using my grandfather's mm-hmm. philosophy. And so they range. They range from, you know, a Native American guy who's been in and out of, I don't know, maybe 12 facilities in California to a fabulous teacher, principal, really, in Philadelphia. The girl who took the video, I don't know how many of your listeners saw a young woman being thrown across the classroom in Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes.
I was able to talk to the girl who took that video and who was arrested for saying, you know, anybody go record this, put it on Snapchat, you know, look, anybody gonna do anything about it? Took her to jail for that. A new, young, very interesting Michael Tubbs, who will become, I believe, knock on wood, the mayor of Stockton, the man who took the video of the Freddie Gray beating in my hometown in Baltimore. Quite a variety of folks, a great distinguished scholar and philosopher of education that your people at the graduate schools of education all over Boston will know about, called Maxine Green. Sherilyn Eiffel, who is the head of the NAACP Legal Defense mm-hmm. Fund, a kid who I interviewed in a Maryland Correctional Institute, young kid in a juvenile facility. So lots of different kinds of people. Psychiatrist from Stanford.
Who's that? We saw something this
yeah,
morning.
It was great.
We were talking. Was his name Alan Bullock?
Yeah.
Tell us about Alan Bullock little bit.
Okay, so Alan, where did you see that? They sent you a tape?
I don't know where we saw it.
It was just some video thing
stuff
we saw.
They sent.
Yeah.
So Alan Bullock, when there was a riot in Baltimore, right during the riots in 2015, one young man beat up, you know, just demolished a police car. And he was arrested, but it became famous because the bail was $500,000. He eventually, went to court. He was sentenced to 12 years, actually served 6 months, and then there'd be a lot of probation. So I think the thing that Alan Bullock illustrates for us very well, I think of people like Alan Bullock as ethnographers of their own experience, mm-hmm. you know, not very educated, but ethnographers of their own experience. I count on them more than I do academics, even though I'm one. And, you know, I think he reveals the profound disdain that young kids in the street have for the for the police, and I bet you it's mutual.
Now, you were surprised we had this. Are you going to be okay if we play it?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, what's the verb? Here is Anna Deavere Smith blanking Alan
Portraying.
Bullock. Portraying. Thank you. Portraying Alan Bullock. Please listen.
I don't even look the police way, tell you the truth. It's not even me. If they look at me, I turn my head. If I look back, I'm not going to mug you. It's always do it. Because if you look at the police so hard or so straight, I see how he was, Freddie Gray, in a way, like around this neighborhood. If the neighborhood police know you in the neighborhood, they don't care about none of that. They're going to do something to you. I don't care what neighborhood you're in, be a quiet neighborhood, anything. If they know you from being bad, not even being bad, being in the area, hanging with somebody that they know that's bad, they're going to rash you. And when they ask you, why are you looking at me like that? They will ask you, why are you looking at me like that? In a smart way, jump out their car, pull in their stick, all that. And I had the police ask me, why am I walking in the street? Why am I crossing the street? What you mean, why am I crossing the street? I say something back, they get out of the car, I get back on the curb. You feel me? There's no need for you to get out of your car, you feel me, and talk to me. You can see why I'm walking across the street. They don't even say, excuse me, sir, come here, none of that. But you just ask me, why am I crossing the street? It's not late outside, it's not none of that. So what are you... A whole lot of police out here just being police, being what they do.
That's unbelievable. That's truly. Are you
We're talking to Anna Deavere Smith, and she was portraying Alan Bullock in that scene. You know, I'm wondering if you think, because we are now talking nonstop about cops and going after unarmed men, the Democratic Convention tomorrow night, we're going to have some mothers who've lost their sons at the hands of police officers. If you think it's a hopeful sign, because I think for most of, this has been going on forever, but I think until a lot of people, well, mostly, you know, white people that didn't experience this, saw this, they didn't believe it. You think it's changing?
I think, first of all, you know, obviously my whole perception of everything changed after Ferguson. I mean, I did my first sort of stage reading of this material right before that, and we've sort of had this very dark, haven't we, film festival of short films. You could have a whole film festival of these short films of these disturbing interactions between citizens and police officers. I mean, you know, the word optimism, it's a funny word. I always think about Cornel West, who was at Harvard for some time. I was asking him one time about the notion of despair, because he was talking about it a lot. And he said, in talking about it, he said, you know, that despair is not where you end, but where you start. And he says, it's a form of hope, he says, you know, not optimism. He says, hope and optimism are different. Optimism is based on the notion that there's enough evidence out there to think that things are going to be better. He says, that's very rational. Says, but hope looks at the evidence and says, doesn't look good at all. Doesn't look good at all. I'm going to make a leap of faith, go beyond the evidence, try to create new possibilities based on visions that become contagious to allow people to engage in heroic actions, always against the odds, no guarantee whatsoever. So I'm a hopeaholic in that way. There I'm stealing Gloria Steinem's phrase. So I think the hope here, I won't call it optimism, it looks very bad. The hope is that there are people who are waking up. And whether they're waking up in terms of getting behind the Black Lives Matter movement, or whether they're waking up and getting behind what they call the All Lives Matter movement, or whether they're waking up in terms of what's going on in the culture of policing in this country, is that we have an extraordinary moment. And also in terms of our schools and of mass incarceration, we do have an extraordinary moment right now to try to do something different. Sherrilyn Ifill, the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, as I mentioned before, is one of the people that I portray. And she talks about how we are on the verge of a new civil rights movement, or maybe one or in it. And it's a combination of both what we need to do in education and what we need to do about criminal justice.
Now, Anna Deavere Smith, since I'm now comfortable with the second act,
oh,
can
good.
I tell you what
I'm so glad.
I'm going to preview for you, because I'm sure you want to know what I'm going to say in my little group. Is
no,
that okay?
No, you can't. You can't
okay.
do that.
Can I do it a little bit?
You want to preview it now?
Yeah, okay. I do. Because okay.
I'm supposed to go for the first act before you start.
I know,
yes.
But maybe it'll affect. Okay.
Well, here's a. Well,
what's that?
What he's going to say is this, because he will get a chance to say, look, I came in here thinking
exactly.
this.
Exactly.
So you're
going to
come in thinking,
go ahead.
Here's what I would say. Since there's so many Harvard references, it seems to me the only way we solve any of this stuff is Bob Putnam was here a few weeks ago, speaking of Harvard, obviously famous for Bowling Alone. His most recent book was Our Kids. Did you get a chance to read Our Kids?
I haven't read Our Kids.
His basic notion is until we decide that the that all kids are our kids, not just the ones who happen to live in our house, are our responsibility, we're never going to solve anything. How do you get to that point?
Because my sense is that
so many people, particularly when they feel
that's
under stress themselves, say, even if it's not malevolent, they basically, I got to worry about myself. That's them. That hasn't happened to me.
It's right. I agree. And you go back and you look at the Kerner Commission report and you think about the 60s and you think about what we're trying to do. The fact is, laws aren't enough. We don't like each other. In the South, they were forced to desegregate their schools. I went down to South Carolina and talked to a woman who was one of the first petitioners in the first desegregation of schools case. It was actually Briggs versus Elliott, not Brown versus Board of Ed. You know what they did? As soon as they were told in South Carolina, Somerville, they had to integrate the schools.
What?
The white people went off and they made their own schools, made religious schools, private schools. So unless we do this work that we is harder, which is how do we develop and enrich a moral imagination so that things that sound like the soft stuff, empathy, love, the people start, the head of
kindness,
the head, the supervisor of the schools for the state of South Carolina started talking about love, a white woman. I said, wait a minute, did you just say love? I said, well, what graduate school of education do you know that has a course on love 101? So, but you see, it is important that we look at these other parts of our human potential. And all movements have had these little segments of people who understand that. But, you know, this idea that you're saying of Putnam is exactly right. But how do we get there? How do we even begin to imagine that we could possibly care about somebody next door, let alone across town?
Okay, may I be superficial for a couple of minutes here, Anna Deavere Smith? I did not know until today.
She hasn't said yes yet, by the way.
Well, I'm hoping she...
I mean, be as superficial as you want. I'm not an elitist, actually.
Well, I knew about Nurse Jackie in West Wing, but I did not know until today that one of your first roles was as Hazel, the shampoo girl, at All My Children.
That's not superficial.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, I was just being Hazel. I was trying to get health insurance. like, you do some of these jobs were called under five. And, you know, if you do under five lines, you try to build up. I never built up enough to get health insurance. I had to kind of abandon the whole thing and go to Carnegie Mellon and get a teaching job. So, no, I was just trying to get health insurance, and I got to be Hazel in the glamour. I think it was called the Glamorama in All My Children.
That was a huge show.
That was a huge hit, but all those soap operas are gone now.
I know they are. I don't know what happened to them, but they are gone now. People watch them all the time. So, and the other thing, I mean, this is probably a cliche takeaway question that you've been asked a million times, but, you know, all the time in the West Wing, you know, any parallels or any things we can learn from the West Wing that would be helpful in this political day?
Well, wasn't that a good question? I mean, the first thing is that, you know, Aaron Sorkin was he's a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I think the company, I mean, a lot of people wanted the world to feel like that. And I think what they want to feel like is that sort of group of people working together very hard on hard things. And actually, I think when the times I've been to the White House and been around those folks, I think that's what they're like. I think they really are. And in fact, I think probably one of the best jobs in the world would be the job that you say, welcome to the White House. I mean, I think whatever White House it is, there's a kind of beehive of activity.
Did you see Michelle Obama last night?
Wasn't that something? That was one. I think that should be considered one of the great speeches in American history. It was so meticulous. It was so disciplined. And she delivered it so well.
You know, you mentioned healthcare a second ago. Let Me Down Easy was one of your deals where healthcare was one of the themes. And I was listening to this thing you did of Peter J. Gomes, who was one of the great heroes from ever. I mean, just one of the... Do you get anxious a Harvard minister at Harvard who was there forever and just revered. Do you get nervous when somebody who you're portraying... And obviously you care about each of the people you're actually sees you portraying.
He came to see it. You know, the late Peter Gomes. He had passed away by the time I did it in New York, but he came to see it here.
And are you anxious when you know he's sitting there watching
you? I was scared to death, but he said he liked it. I can't remember. I think the people who were taking him out of the theater were sort of amused that he is Peter Gomes. You know, I think as he left the theater, he said, "Carry on, child," to my assistant. "Carry on, child."
Yeah.
You know, so
his bow tie.
Oh, and the whole thing, the straw hat, all of it.
So yeah. Can we play a piece of that too?
Why not? That'd be fun.
This is from Let Me Down Easy. This is obviously Anna too. Peter J. Gomes is talking about being at the hospital and present when somebody dies and what it's like for the rest of the people in the hospital room. Here it is.
And then the hard part is dealing with the people who are left around the bedside. Because inevitably there's a sense that we failed. We haven't done what we're supposed to do. And at the gravesite, I read the prayer book office. I am the resurrection and the life. All that stuff. Here on earth have we no continuing place. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. This is it, folks. Well, don't really say it that way. But I insist that the coffin be lowered away in the presence of everybody there. I insist that you see the coffin go down into the ground. You need to know that this is a form of finality. And my little homily is something like, all that is mortal about brother or sister is in this box, and it's going into the ground. And we cast ashes and dirt into here, reminding us that this is where it all came from. And we will not meet again under these circumstances. So, cherish the moment. I do say that. I say, cherish the moment.
That's Anna DeVere Smith portraying Peter
really
Gomes in Let Me Down Easy. She's at the ART doing Notes from the Field, doing time in education, starting August 20th.
Now, another supervision note. I did not know until today that you had been on Law and Order Special Victims. I wanted to go back and reload this because there's no show on television, I'm embarrassed to say, that I have sat and watched one after the other on the reruns. It like, drags you in.
I wasn't even on that show till last December, and I really think I must have been the only standing actor in New York City who had not yet been on the show.
It's great. I'm going to go back and look you up to see. Well, who'd you play on Law and Order Special Victims?
It's interesting.
Are you the good person or the bad person?
I played a prison warden.
Oh.
So wasn't that apt, you know, last December. And we went to Sing Sing and other real prisons upstate. And the people at Sing Sing were standing around watching. They were like, there's never been a woman prison warden in the state of New York, but you did okay. You did okay.
Did you ever go to I used to work at Bedford Hills, the only women's
Max.
You've been to Bedford Hills?
Yeah, I went up there. One of my first shows I ever did, I went up there and interviewed a warden up there. And then I went up later with Glenn Close, who lives near there, was doing some very interesting work with those nuns. Those two nuns ran up there.
We're talking to Anna DeVere Smith. What do you find, you know, based on what you've done in the past, whether it was in the wake of Crown Heights or in the wake of what the post Rodney King riots in L.A., which a lot of us have seen a lot about lately, and a thing we love, O.J. Made in America, which I thought
wasn't that amazing?
Yes,
absolutely,
it was amazing.
Do you track at all what happens in the world with those who spend time watching you and listening to you?
And let me just say also that PBS has filmed put all three of my works on screen, and thank goodness for that, because it's why kids can do these plays now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough, I think, to just read it; they need to see.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, PBS replayed some of this after the Baltimore riots. I with Let Me Down Easy, I'm in touch with a lot of the people. I certainly follow race relations very carefully. I was sort of disturbed to read something about Crown Heights where there are people who live there who don't even know what happened. And to me, that's kind of like a failure of history when we go, well, why are we repeating these things? Why is it just a bit? If we go back and look at the Kerner Commission report, what was that, 1968, something like that? We go, well, what happened? It's not any better. Part of it is we don't know any history about what happened. We're not invested in a history of us, of what we've been doing and not doing.
Yeah,
it just evaporates.
We were just talking about that with the Nancy Kane, Harvard historian, about in terms of our election. Presidential thing. You know, can you get back to the schools for a second? Jim mentioned the fact that there was a big story in the Boston Globe about the thing that your play is about, the basic bias against kids of color in terms of they're getting harsher punishments and more expulsions and stuff like that. I'm obsessed with the schools, particularly the urban schools, which I think are not failing. They failed. And that one of the things that would make such a difference, we operate like it's 1950.
Yes.
You know, like there are still mothers at home
yes.
at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
We could have these schools operating from 7 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock at night. It makes such a huge difference. And kids that are even in the so-called rich schools, you parents are having to hire tutors for their kids because
right.
it's not they can't get it all in the day. Have you thought about that? Have you thought about the whole?
I have.
Yeah.
Well, it's also that. You know, it's Lorraine Powell Jobs, who you all know who she is, right? Has this fabulous
Steve's widow.
Yeah,
widower. Is she widow or widower?
She's a widow.
Widow.
Thank you.
So, but she's very invested in education. Always has been. Had something of college track. Now she has an extraordinary program called the XQ Institute. They've been taking ideas from people. From
I don't
everything
know about
from
this.
Chefs to architects to teachers about new ideas about what school can be. And the premise of the XQ Institute is that this way we think of a high school is so old-fashioned and we haven't really revised what it is. And just what you said is very important. The assumption that mothers were going to be home. The assumption that kids were going to be living in two-parent families. That's not even the case with rich people.
No,
you know,
it's not.
Anymore. So we have to if first of all, I don't even think it's fair to call this thing the school-to-prison pipeline because we are sort of implying that the fault is the schools and the teachers. This is really about poverty, right? And if we really want schools to be the intervention in what is now something like 4 or 5 generations of poverty, violence, trauma, drugs, if we really want that to happen, we have to revise what they are. We have to revise how teachers are trained. I went to Finland. They did have what was considered the best education system in the world. Might be neck and neck with Singapore right now. And, you know, they think, for example, they don't even have special ed. Those kids are in school with everybody else, and they don't medicalize it. They don't pathologize it. We pathologize everything. They look at it pedagogically, like what do I need to do to teach this child? And the teachers continue to research. And it's a country that really respects teachers. So if we want our teachers to be these miracle workers, then we're going to have to train them differently, and we're going to have to take care of them, you know, to make sure they have what they need to be effective in what's really a war zone.
So I know you don't want to. I mean, you know, hope is one thing, optimism is another thing. But did you see either any reason for hope or optimism in what we're doing now in the United States? I mean, Obama's guy
Arnie Duncan.
Arnie Duncan had some innovative ideas. But is there anybody that's thinking these things?
I've interviewed about 250 people now, and I have met so many people who are doing extraordinary work and applying all kinds of talent to this issue, from like a judge on the Yurok Reservation, who's working very hard with very few resources, to a neuroendocrinologist at Rockefeller University. I mean, he could spend all this time just looking at depression and trying to make a new drug, but he's trying to think about what are the things we can do to increase the plasticity of the brain of children, you know, who have grown and lived in trauma. Some of the kids themselves who I'm meeting, I feel, have the potential to turn things around. Very, very inspiring principles. So I think, you know, Obama's the first sitting president to go to a federal
penitentiary.
Yeah. First sitting president to go to an Indian reservation. And all of this really happened. It's really happened. So somebody will build on that. I feel very excited. I wouldn't have stayed in this project, which I really began thinking about in 2011. I wouldn't have stuck in it if it weren't that every step of the way, I'm fully engaged with new and exciting ideas. It's kind of like they talk about Thomas Jefferson that, oh, when you study Jefferson, you could, because of his what he was interested in, you could learn about wine, you could learn about bugs, you could learn about Bach, you could learn all these things. If you want to look at education right now, there's so much you can learn about because there's so many people around it who want to fix it, who see it as an opportunity, not just a problem, but a challenge. People with big ideas.
Anna Deavere Smith, before you go, you've been very generous with your time. I said in the introduction of One Woman Show, and then I amended it, said One Woman, One Man. Tell us about Marcus Shelby. Oh. I was listening to him this morning. He is surreal.
He's really something. So Marcus Shelby is a San Francisco Israeli where I met him. He's very, you know, he's like, you know, at the center of everything there. He is a fantastic jazz bass player. And, you know, I've been doing these one-woman shows for a long time, but I've recently started to, you know, experiment with having musicians. Joshua Roman and I worked on a piece called On Gross, On Grace. He's a concert cellist, and I worked with Bobby McDuffie, concert violinist, on our work on King's Letter from Birmingham Jail, and now with Marcus Shelby on this piece. And so I'm very pleased to have him on stage with me with his beautiful music. And we should mention, too, that I have the fortune to be being directed by Leonard Folia on this piece, who did Thurgood on Broadway. He did lots of work that your listeners know about. So it's a great team.
Not only am I excited about going, I know Marjorie is too, I'm not even nervous about the second act now, thanks to you.
But you see, we also have somebody called the Welcome. I believe that the theater and all arts institutions should exude what I call a radical welcome. Mm. And so we have these people that we're bringing every night to do the radical welcome. And I'm going to go back to the American Repertory Theater and tell them that the two of you would love to do a radical welcome on one of the nights.
Okay.
And greet the audience and tell them what they have in store, since you're not afraid anymore.
Okay. Oh.
I think we're there, Jim.
Yeah,
I think we're there.
We're
love the ART because you get so close.
It's going to be closer.
Yeah, it will be really
Anna,
close,
it's a
Jim.
Thrill to meet you. We can't
yeah,
wait to see
you. Very excited to meet you, too. Thank you very much for being here. Anna Deavere Smith is award-winning actress and playwright. Her latest one-woman show is Notes from the Field, Doing Time and Education on Stage at the ART in Cambridge from August 20th through September 17th. To learn more, go to AmericanRepertoryTheater.org. Coming up, it's our annual summer conversation. It's 90 degrees outside. You know what I'm talking about? How do you keep cool without your AC? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.